I'd like to give a quick overview and just an update on the status of the Gravity Probe B satellite. As many of you know, the Gravity Probe B satellite will have four orbiting gyroscopes, and they'll be in a polar orbit. And it's designed to measure two relativistic effects. The first of these is the geodetic effect, which is due to the interaction of the spinning gyroscope with its orbital motion around the Earth. This produces a drift rate of the spin axis of 6.6 arc seconds per year in a 650 kilometer altitude orbit. The second effect is the frame dragging or motional effect. And this produces a drift rate of 42 milliarc seconds per year. The objective of GPB is to measure these both of these effects to an accuracy of significantly better than 0.5 milliarc seconds per year. In order to measure these effects, we have to measure them relative to a reference star. And then, of course, the question comes up is whether this reference star has a proper motion with respect to the more distant stars. And the guide star which has been selected is HR 8703, also known as IMPEG. The reason that it has been selected is that it's both visually bright and is also a radio source. For this reason, VLBI astronomy can be used to measure the proper motion of this guide star relative to extragalactic radio sources. The visual magnitude is 5.69, which allows us gives us enough light for the telescope, which is originally attached to the gyroscopes through the quartz block, has a declination of 16.84 degrees, so it's not far from the equator. And so if it was exactly on the celestial equator, then it would maximize the motional effect. It's also has an ecliptic latitude of 22 degrees, so the sun, over the course of the year, the sun doesn't come that close to the guide star. So right now there's a team which is led by Irwin Shapiro, which is measuring the proper motion of this guide star relative to two extragalactic sources. And this shows the position of the guide star relative to these extragalactic sources, starting from the first measurements that were made by Lestrade in 1991. So this set of measurements were made by Lestrade in 1991. And then since 1997, the group led by Irwin Shapiro has been making four VLBI measurements of the position of the guide star per year. So we expect that by 2002, the uncertainty in the proper motion of the guide star will be less than 0.1 milliarc seconds per year. Then to quickly give you a overview of the main systems of the Gravity Probe B, of course, at the heart of the experiment is the gyroscope, which is made out of fused quartz and polished to a sphericity of approximately 1 microinch. It's coated with a thin layer of niobium, which has a superconducting transition temperature of 9 degrees Kelvin. As you spin a superconductor, it produces a London moment along its spin axis. And then on one half of the housing, there's a pickup loop, a superconducting pickup loop, which we use to measure the flux through the pickup loop. And with that, we can tell what the orientation of the spin axis is. The gyroscope is electrostatically supported using the electrodes on the interior of the housing, and it's spun up with a helium gas jet. The four gyroscopes are inserted into a quartz block, which is rigidly attached to the telescope. The telescope looks out through a set of four windows at the guide star. This entire assembly operates at a little bit above 2 degrees Kelvin. And you can see here that it's placed in the probe. So the gyroscopes are down here with the telescope rigidly attached. This entire region here operates just above 2 degrees Kelvin. And then there are the set of four windows. And so the light from the guide star comes in through the four windows to the telescope here. The probe is placed in the superfluid liquid helium door. And one of the things that we have to be particularly careful about is the magnetic shielding. So within the door, there's a cryoperm shield. There's also a superconducting shield. There are local shields around the gyroscopes. And then, in fact, the gyroscope itself tends to exclude the magnetic field. So with this four sets of shields, we can get a very good attenuation of any variations in the external field. The doer is placed within a framework which is the spacecraft, and the solar arrays are attached to the spacecraft. Also on the spacecraft, there's a retroreflector which can be used for laser range measurements to the satellite, and there are two GPS receivers that can also be used to determine the orbit of the satellite. Okay. Switching from the hardware to the status of GPV, the payload has been completed, and we're in the midst of verification testing. So this is a not particularly clear photograph of the liquid helium door. The probe has been inserted into the door. The four gyroscopes are inserted in the quartz block, and they're attached to the flight telescope. So this entire assembly is cold now, and it will remain cold until the end of the experiment. The liquid helium door holds 2,400 liters of liquid helium, which will give us about a 19-month on-orbit lifetime. We're in the midst of our second payload verification. In the first payload verification, many things worked extremely well. We did find a couple of problems. The major one was a thermal problem with the probe, and we had to remove the probe and correct that problem before we could continue on with the verification. The testing that we've done, the payload meets all the science requirements, and one of the things that has just happened recently is that this entire door with flight gyroscopes and telescope was sent to Lockheed in Sunnyvale, where it underwent an acoustic test. We were very pleased that this acoustic test went very well. And just this morning, in fact, the door came back from Lockheed in Sunnyvale to Stanford University, where we'll continue this verification testing. In the meantime, a lot of work has been done on the spacecraft, and the spacecraft is 90% complete. And this shows the solar arrays and one of the mass trim mechanisms, which is used to tune out the mass offset and the moments of inertia so that our helium thrusters can control the satellite better. Our schedule from now until launch is that we expect that this payload testing will be done by the 1st of October of this year. It will be sent from Stanford over to Lockheed in Palo Alto, where the payload will be inserted into the spacecraft. And I believe that this will take a fairly short time, 3 weeks. And then there's several months of space vehicle testing. This is not only testing, functional testing at Lockheed in Palo Alto, but it's also the environmental testing, the which includes the thermal vacuum test, which will be done at Lockheed in Sunnyvale. Now, then launch is scheduled for October 30th of 2002. Once the satellite is launched, we expect that there are going to be 40 to 60 days of an initialization period. We'll be collecting science mission data over 13 to 15 months, and then there will be about 30 to 60 days of post-mission calibration. This time has been specifically reserved to try to demonstrate that the systematic experimental effects are as small as we expect. If you plot the accuracy versus time, the dominant feature here is that the statistical noise is decreasing as 1 over to the t to the 3 halves power, since you're measuring a rate of the gyroscope precession. So what this will be, the results will be, it'll be an experimental test of general relativity in space. One of the interesting features is that we're using a special relativistic effect. The aberration of starlight will be used as a known calibrating signal. So in this respect, the experiment is similar to the Pound-Rebka experiments on the gravitational redshift, where they were using the Doppler shift of a target moving of an absorber moving at a couple of millimeters per hour in order to calibrate the gravitational redshift. We will be able to measure the gravitational deflection of light and use that as a cross check, but we don't believe that we will be able to improve the accuracy of the gravitational deflection of light. The maximum gravitational deflection is about 20 milliarcseconds. We will hope that we have a very precise measurement of the motional or lens tearing effect, and we hope that this will be the most accurate experimental test of general relativity. Thank you.
Question.
Measurements of the same detail particles from other experiments?
The geodetic effect produces a drift rate of about 6.6 arc seconds per year in a 640 kilometer orbit. The requirement that we've been working to, our agreement with NASA, is that we will measure both the geodetic and the motional effect to an accuracy of better than 0.5 milliarcseconds per year. We're hoping that we can do significantly better than that, so we're hoping that we can push the accuracy down to 0.1 or 0.2 milliarcseconds per year. At this level, the accuracy is a couple parts in 10 to the fifth. Okay, if you compare that to say the Shapiro time delay measurements or the deflection of light, they've been measured to about in part in 10 to the third. So we're hoping to get almost a two order of magnitude improvement over the other experimental tests of relativity. Ron.
Maybe a vague question, but I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to ask. But some years ago, JPL, the VLBI group, was interested in comparing the VLBI frame to the dynamical frame of the solar system using the Viking data. At one point there, I was involved because they were asking me, is it possible that there's a drift of the iceberg? And though I thought at the level that they were measuring things, there couldn't be, or if you look for a z-squared term in elevation or something like that, sort of transverse Doppler effect, you're limited as to how, as whether there's a cosmic vorticity. But this is, I think, is a much more accurate measurement than you were making. Of course, the elevation is now better known. Is anyone looking at the idea that maybe if this thing detects a drift different from lens steering, that it's not really a test of lens steering, but it's the first detection of the cosmic vorticity around it?
Well, let's see. I know that the some of the data from COBE, some of the microwave background radiation data, can place quite strong limits on that effect. Okay, and I don't believe that we will be able to improve on those limits. I believe the data from COBE actually places a tighter limit on that than we should be able to measure.
So you've had some problems with the Dewar in the last roughly year that caused a delay in launch. Are those problems totally solved, and is there any worry at the present time that you're still dealing with?
No, the main problem with the Dewar that we had, it was a thermal problem. The four windows are supposed to absorb a lot of the heat that comes down the probe. And then the way the probe was designed, it was designed that heat be conducted thermally away through the walls of the probe into the Dewar, where it meets up with the vacuum-cooled shields within the Dewar. What we found when the probe was cooled down was that there was a poor thermal connection between those windows and the probe walls. This was quite a surprise, because an earlier probe that had been built using the same methods had very good thermal conduction through the probe walls. We believe that the cause of this was a failed epoxy joint. But what has been done is the probe was removed, and a hole was drilled from the outer copper ring through the probe walls into an inner copper ring, and copper plugs were inserted in order to improve the thermal conduction. Okay, the probe has since been cooled down. We've measured the temperatures of all the windows, and in fact, there's even a significant improvement over the previous probe that was built. So that's all working very well, and we think that problem is completely solved.
Okay, thank you, everybody, here once again. Thank you.